epic. Epic. Let's try that again. Ladies and gentlemen, what is up? It is Tuesday night, and it is time for another episode of Inside the Game. Not live on three, that's tomorrow. So I got a little itchy on the trigger finger there. I don't know if you guys heard it, but I played the wrong intro music. So sorry to ruin the show. 20 seconds, even 5 seconds into it. I apologize. It's a bad show. In control, Greg, Phil, you can blame it on me, okay?
We'll do it live.
No problem. We got that covered. Guys, what is up? Welcome to episode 4. It's May 24, 2011. And excited to talk more StarCraft 2. We don't do it enough, really.
I agree.
Indeed, we don't.
All right. So I can tell you're just all thrilled again for another episode. You're like, can we open the phones yet?
Get to the callers.
Yeah. Can we just open the phones right now? We know. We got it. You got to wait. There's some things we got to talk about. First off, how's everyone's week been? Idra?
It was good. I'm tired, but it was fun.
Yeah. Jeff?
Busy, man. Went and saw my girl in Portland and was very fortunate to do that. But then also, buzzing around, did a commercial for Kingston, which should be released pretty soon, and I'm very excited about that.
Is that commercial, could that maybe be aired on a onemoregame.tv program, since, you know, we have a show sponsored by Kingston?
Well, Sir Scoots does happen to be in pretty good touch with Kingston. I believe that's something that we should get him to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I like the sexy Ram montage with the music, but a commercial with In Control would be much more appealing, let me tell you. And Pain User, what about you? Been doing some casting this week?
Long week, man. Just been working long hours.
I could tell, man. You look a little slow
this weekend.
Yeah, you got to hang out with who?
I got to hang out with my girl this weekend.
Oh, nice.
It was cool.
Hey, wait, not Slasher. That was a while ago, right?
Hey, who's your girl?
that was like 2 or 3 weekends ago. That was fun too, though. New York's a crazy city. I had a really good time out there.
It is a crazy city.
Lot of people, a lot of different kinds of people. It's like a melting pot.
It is. It's crazy, and it's plus Slashers out there, so you never know what to expect. So, yep. Guys, welcome to episode 4 of Inside the Game. Our goal here is every week I'm going to try to get these guys to smile before the show begins and get them all pumped up. But we'll get there once the calls start. We try to harness the expansive knowledge amongst these three guys below me, and you're really lucky to have such great access to them. Got some awesome, awesome questions this week via email. I appreciate all the people that are emailing in. I hope you guys realize, you know, it's a little bit tougher to ask, like, these three guys a question that is, like, this long. 1, 2, 3 pages. So, if you can keep them down to a paragraph, it really help. I know that sometimes it's very impossible, but you guys are getting much better with that. And, of course, maybe this week you'll get a chance to talk to Goat Lord again. Goat Lust is what I meant to say. Totally. Thank you for saving me on that. So we're going to jump right into our segments, guys. And, of course, we're going to go with the one that people really seem to like. And that, of course, is You're Doing It Wrong. And you can email your thoughts, suggestions, what you want to hear at itg@onemoregame.tv. And before we actually go into the topics that we've got, someone, after we kind of talked about the whole destructible rocks thing, and that turned out to be total bullshit, we're talking about putting a burrowed roach under a lower supply depot so that it couldn't raise anymore. Idra, have you ever done this before?
I make it a policy to not make roaches versus Terran, so no.
Okay. So I did get a few replays from some folks. Thanks for sending those in. But the guy that did ask, it is true. Were you aware of that? That I didn't know.
It makes sense because I know burrowed roaches can move through lower depots but not raised depots. So
Yeah.
I hadn't really thought about it, but yeah, it makes sense.
So there's like a certain method to the madness, I think, because you have to move through the supply depot and then basically stop and hold position your roach, and then they can't raise it.
Do you have to position it, or do you just let it sit there?
Well, I mean, actually, I did get a replay, and I will fire it up so that people could see. But there were a few cases where if the roach was not on hold position and the depot raised, the roach would, like, slide out of the way, almost like a force field slides a unit a little bit. Hmm. Yeah. I'll load this up. Okay. As a Terran pain user, has this ever happened to you?
No, it's definitely never happened to me. I've had roaches sneak into my base through a lower depot, for sure. But, I mean, like, strategically, what are you going to gain from blocking a lower depot? Like,
well,
if it's lowered, you can get in, you know?
Right, exactly. And I think that's kind of one of the points of the segment, too, is because we always, read these threads and, like, dude, you can do this. And why doesn't Idran, do this all the time? It could win him a shitload of games. And, these guys are talking about maybe putting a roach there to let your lings run in. And it's like, at what point are you having tunneled movement, burrow, and your lings are going to go in and do a bunch of damage? I mean, can you guys think about this? I want you to consider this and say, no, this isn't viable. If it's not.
If you have all the things already, then sure. It's like, it doesn't really cost you anything to do at that point. It's unlikely to really pay off, so you shouldn't be aiming to do this as like a goal. But if you're in a situation where you happen to have talon claws, and you're looking to do a speed link counter, then sure, why not? But no, on the whole, it's not really a tactic you should be aiming to do.
It's kind of like the queens and the overlords.
It's just one of those things where it's cool to know about it so that if a situation arises, you have the ability to execute that. But if we go anywhere beyond like 35 seconds talking about this, then we've officially wasted time, in my opinion. So.
Okay. All right. Well, then I won't even show what we've got here. Thanks for sending those replays in, but the 30 seconds is up according to In Control. All right. All right. I like it. Make it rain.
Baby.
It's totally fine.
That's
so, I'll just let this play and I'll admire this. I'll never do it either. Moving to Korea. And the reason I wanted to actually bring this up is because I think that there's a common misconception, not only amongst some people that are in the StarCraft community, but also some comments that were made by some GSL folks about why foreigners weren't accepting the invitations to certain tournaments. And so it kind of seemed appropriate to put it in the "you're doing it wrong," because what was once thought to be the, oh my God, you've got to move to Korea and get a house going and play in order to be huge in StarCraft 2 has suddenly changed. So I guess the part of doing it wrong is actually moving to Korea, doing it wrong. And I know that Idra, you obviously have a lot of experience here in Control. I know that you've considered it. In fact, you were out there once, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Idra was my landlord.
So let's talk about this. Let's kind of air it. I want, sure, for the guys that are saying, well, why doesn't Idra go back and just totally kick ass? Or why doesn't InControl or pain user? And, I want to hear from you guys as to why. And maybe if you think otherwise, why not? Who wants to start on this one?
Probably start with Idra, I'd say.
So all right. Most experience?
Well, I think, just at the most practical level, I think there's actually more money available outside Korea if you play in absolutely everything you can. Like, if you have a team that will send you to any tournament you want to, like EG will for me, and you play in all the big online leagues, there's just so much prize money available that even though GSL has the $40,000, $50,000 first place, that's to win the tournament, and it takes a month to do that. Whereas here we have ongoing 1,000, 10,000, some, like NASL 50,000. There's just a lot of money available outside Korea, and there's a lot more things to do. Like in GSL, if you lose first round, which can happen to anyone, Nesty was knocked out first round last month, then you have a month of essentially nothing, barring a couple of special tournaments here and there. And really, it's incredibly boring, and it's hard to find motivation. Like, a lot of the times if I lost early, I would just not practice for another 2 weeks, and that's bad for your game. And finally, I think that foreigners are really catching up in terms of just overall their approach to RTS. They're taking a lot more seriously, they're practicing a lot more, and they're getting better in general. The Koreans are still better, but it's nothing like it was in StarCraft 1, where you literally had to be there if you wanted to compete at the highest level. So I just think non-Korean StarCraft 2 is just catching up, and living outside of Korea is quite a bit more comfortable in other aspects of life for me. So
right, which I mean, you know, no one can really understand until they've been embedded in another culture. And you were there for a very long time. Even, I've said before, even traveling for 5 days to another country can just be mentally draining. Like, I can only imagine if you compound that by so much. But you lived out there for a very, very long time.
About 3 years.
3 years, yeah. So that had to be one of the biggest, you know, pluses about coming back, aside from the game itself.
Yeah, being back, you know, in a country where I speak the language and living with my friends and stuff, it's really nice, yeah.
Jeff, let's talk a little bit about from your perspective, too,
yeah.
Because if you would have, say, been really successful, stayed out there, you could also consider that there may have been many opportunities that you would have missed. But what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me the most appropriate way to analyze this would be through cost-benefit analysis. If you have the cost of traveling, living abroad, living in one of the most expensive cities in all the world to live in, the language barrier, it's not a native English-speaking country. There are enough people that do speak English, but it's not like you can just easily get around with English. It's quite difficult in that sense. Time zone, okay? Korea exists in a time zone that's very much so inconvenient for Westerners, be it from Europe or America. If you want to participate in functions with your team that's Western-based, this is made much more difficult. If you want to, as Idris said, participate in tournaments that seem to be as, if not more, lucrative in terms of prize pool options, then you're doing so at the expense of your own sleep schedule, but also at the discomfort of latency, which is another cost. The Korean server is fantastic for internal training in Korea, which I'll get to in a moment in the benefit analysis. But in terms of cost, it does remove you from the Western scene, which is what is most relevant to you outside of Korea, which is, again, something I'll analyze in the benefit analysis. But even for me, where I would go to Korea and I would have Artosis, Tasteless, Idra, and their posse, if you will, of people to kind of surround myself with and get around with, it's still expensive and it's still difficult and it's still secluded to that group of people. So I found it enjoyable, and I probably would find it enjoyable for a longer period of time than most foreigners would. But most foreigners don't have the infrastructure in place that I would have had to go into that situation and have people show me around, take care of me, and make it more enjoyable. So the benefit analysis of Korea then, with all that being the cost, is that the level of play is more dense and higher across the board, right? Like, there are more better players in Korea, so you're less likely on the ladder to hit someone who's just trash. You're probably going to hit a roughly higher degree of player continuously. So it's better training in that sense. Also, the top players in all the world are 99% or, you know, 90% in Korea at this point in time. You're going to find the best Terran, the best Protoss, the best Zerg probably in Korea. And the, you know, top five of each of those races, it's mostly Korean. So the potential for training is significantly higher there. And the other, of course, advantage is that when you play in Korea, you're most likely training for an offline experience. So if you can get your nerves out of the way, and if you can sit in a GSL booth and compete at the highest level, then you can transfer that very, very well to an MLG setting or a DreamHack. Or some of these other tournaments. So the experience, the training, that's all fantastic. But when you use the cost-benefit analysis, you're finding that, unfortunately, in all the categories and to a higher degree, it makes more sense not to go to Korea these days. In Brood War, it used to be that that was the only place you could go. That was absolutely the only place. So those costs were like, whatever, it's what I want to do, it's what I have to do. And now it's like, I don't have to do that, and do I really want to do that? Because yes, Korea is exciting, it's fun to live in, but I am getting paid a lot of money to compete here, there's a lot of content options, there's my team's forming a house, etc. So then it becomes more of a like, not really. I'd like to maybe try it over there. But and I know I'm long winded on this, but to your point, too, you're bringing this up in the context of doing it wrong. GSL, it's a month long tournament. So you're hamstrung. If you go over to Korea, you have got to be there or at least plan to be there for at least a month. That's a huge commitment. And also, right, you're kind of in flux because you're there for a month if you make it to the very end, for Pete's sakes. Most players, I mean, the best finish we've had is Jinro. Everybody else has been 1, 2, 3 rounds. Idris made it to the round of 8 a couple of times. That's not a full month, you know? So just kind of the nature of the tournament, the length that you could potentially be staying there for, it's not conducive to foreigners going over there on a regular basis.
And, you know, as you kind of summed up there, just a huge commitment. And now we've had the instance of Idra living in Korea. Jeff, you've gone over there, but of course found a more opportunity. Pain user, did you ever at any time consider going to Korea? You know, especially, I'm just going to call it the when it was, let's be honest, let's be not fluffy here, when it was the fad. It was an early fad and maybe even a misconception that, oh, my God, you got to go to Korea.
Yeah, I mean, I had a chance to go for the World Invitational, but TT1 beat me in the final round of the qualifier. At the very least, I think it's, like, a good idea to go out there, get immersed in the culture for a little while, play all those players, learn the different play styles, and just learn how to train the way that the Koreans train. Because you can read so many things online, you can read so many things on Team Liquid about the experience and like hear firsthand accounts and stuff. But I feel like at the end of the day, if you really go out there, stay out there for a month, live in a pro gaming house and train, it's a good experience regardless. You're going to get much better, period, at the end of the day. In Idris' case, I mean, he was out there for 3 years, so he can come back and he still has those mechanics and he still has the work ethic and all that stuff instilled in him. So he's in a much better position to just, you know, not necessarily hang out, but he knows what he needs to know to put in time on his own now. But I think definitely for a player like me and for somebody who hasn't been out there before, it's a really good idea just to have the experience.
And I could certainly understand that perspective, sort of getting the best of both worlds. Yeah. So, I mean, I know that Idra, I mean, you've even commented about that before in the past, that experience has, you know, helped you out a lot.
Certainly.
Yeah, so, I mean, really the bottom line is that the times have changed. No longer is it even a thought. It's almost, you know, sort of a privilege. I think what's going to happen, my prediction, and we'll talk about it, you know, on future episodes, see if it comes true, is that we're going to see more Koreans wanting to get involved with the international scene because it's getting friggin' big.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Yeah, and we're already seeing it a little bit. But when, as Greg said, you know, when Nesty or I don't know if it was Greg or Jeff, but when Nesty gets knocked out and then you have a month to do nothing, you know, is that suddenly going to be an opportunity to, okay, well, I'm going to go play international events?
We had Ace go to frickin' Australia for a tournament. When in Broodward did a, you know, like, did a lone Korean ever travel to an obscure place like that? It's just, I think you're absolutely right. I think we'll see more. We're already seeing more Koreans go to DreamHack. We have an exchange program with the MLG. So I can't wait till there's Koreans moving to the U.S. I hope we get to that point. That'd be amazing.
All right. Well, we're gonna have a brief discussion on one other thing for You're Doing It Wrong. Then we're going to go right into the mailbag. So let me move on to that. It is going to be, if I could find this shit here, effective scouting. And I just want to read to you what this guy said, because I think it's pretty funny. I used to scout my opponent, he says, run around his base a bit, attack a worker, and leave. This would leave me feeling very good about my play, and I would demand the unconditional surrender of my opponent. Of course, the only real information I gained from it was the knowledge of where my opponent's base was. And I thought that was a humorous way to kind of get into his for him to get to his question. He says he's scouting wrong, and when he scouts right, he feels like he responds to his opponent's wrong. So even though that's like a whole nother topic, effective scouting you know, what this guy says, I think is almost a carbon copy of like the shit that I do. And then I'm wondering, like, well, what am I really gaining? Like, yes, you pick up these things and you know to identify. But he goes on to ask things like, when should I be thinking about throwing away that overlord to get the next piece of information? At what point in the game am I trying to get my next piece of information beyond what I just did with my initial worker? Who wants to, you know, from a Zerg perspective, since the question did come from that, can you give us some insight to that at all, Indra?
Well, specifically what he asked in the question was scouting like a 6 or 7 gate off 2 base. And on that one, is kind of generally as soon as Speed Overlord or an Overseer finishes, that attack is moving out to hit, so you don't really scout based on that. There you want to probe into their natural and see what you can find. A lot of sentries really are early on points of that. If they don't have either of the guests, the natural, then it's definitely going to be a warp gate all in. If they haven't been chrono boosting probes out, or if they're saving up a lot of chrono boosts, that often means there'll be a heavy warp gate attack. But really, this isn't a question for a tiny segment like this because it's so situational and there's so much going on. It's just like a massive amount of experience goes in this, and every situation's different.
Okay.
So this is going to be really hard to address.
Well, you know, and since, you know, for the sake of time, even if you were to pull back a little bit and someone wants to improve what they're doing there, granted it's situational, but at least for them to start sacking an overlord, at least to get an idea on what they're dealing with so they can start to build off of this experience, what would you tell them?
I mean, Ian? Go ahead.
Just to think about stuff. Generally, it's pretty logical. Like, the most important thing is actually to do the scouting. To send the overlord in, or to probe around with your zerglings, to send the drone scout out and keep it alive as long as possible. And then when you see what they're doing, just kind of think about it. Because you see they're spending all their chrono boosts on the warp gate upgrade or their units. That means they want to have units out really quickly, or they want to have warp gate done really quickly. That means they're either going to be aggressive, or they need a bunch of units to expand. And in either case, they're going to be vulnerable if you make a lot of units. So either you can roachling all in their expansion, or you have a bunch of roachling to defend their attack. Whereas if they're spending chrono boosts on their nexus, then they're going to have a bunch of probes, they're going to have a really strong economy, but they're not going to have a lot of units, so then you want to just sit back and defend yourself. So really, it's just a logical process from there, and the thing I would tell newer players to focus on most is to actually do the scouting. Just focus on trying to get information from your opponent.
Okay. Payne, you wanted to throw something in there?
Well, I was going to say, like, if it's a strictly, like, low-level player to develop your scouting, try and focus on like every game you play and certain games when you lose, if try and look at the patterns of your opponent and see specific timing windows, like, you know, hey, maybe from like the 6 minute mark to the 6 minute 30 second mark, this player is like dropping his dark shrine, or he's, you know, doing whatever. And as you lose to those strategies, you got to develop those specific timing windows in each matchup where, like, hey, it's a really important timing window for me to get a good look of what's going on in his base. And that's just like one aspect of scouting. That you want to be scouting his army composition, but I'm talking about specifically like looking for tech buildings at specific times in the game. Like, I'm sure in ZVP there's like times to check for the Stargate, how many gateways he has. There's probably a 30 second window where it's really important to see how many gateways there are. So just try and develop those, try and look for habits in your opponents, and then just like instill those times into when you play. Just
so
like remind yourself.
Is there not like one time where you're like, oh, it's about time I throw down a scan?
Yeah, for sure.
Is it the same time all the time? You know, like.
Generally, like around the, well, at least against Protoss, Zerg is pretty fluid. It's very hard for Zerg to like completely surprise you unless it's like, you know, a greater spire and you have absolutely no clue that it's coming. But generally, TVZ is a lot more straightforward and the timings are much more set in stone. But against Protoss, like right around the 6 minute mark, 6 minute 30 mark, it's really important to check his natural. See if there's a nexus going up. If there's no nexus, you know, all kinds of warning signs should be going off in your head. If there's no nexus, then it's really important to get a look at what's going on inside of his base, get a gateway count, and try and find some sort of tech building. And also to count his warp gate units and infer what he's doing. So if you see like a bunch of stalkers and zealots, he's not spending his gas on sentries, you probably know something's up. It's either going to be DTs, it could be void ray, you know.
All right.
So yeah, for, and there's times later on in the game too, and that's more, that's much more experience based, where like you just get a hunch, and you kind of know something's up.
The StarCraft sixth sense kicks in.
Uh-huh.
In Control, from your perspective,
it's different actually. I would say even from a speaking, I guess more specifically from the Protoss perspective, I would say that I would go even a step back than these guys are talking, and I would say, scout your opponent, look for the very generic things like gas, no gas, you know, two or three barracks or gateways, the kind of weird stuff, fast spawning pool, like seven or eight supply, whatever. Gather that information. The first attack unit that comes out, like a Marine, a Stalker, after Zealot, which you can outrun, or the spawning pool finishes, you want to leave. And when you leave, you don't want to go home as a Protoss player with a probe. You want to do things like stash it in a corner so you can do what I call a mid-game scout, where you go check, like, okay, he's developing his economy, I don't have to worry about an all-in, or, holy cow, he's got two drones as natural, it looks like he's doing some kind of all-in. And it's very, very basic, there's not a whole lot of multitasking involved there, but it just gets you in the habit of finding your opponent, making the read as to what the early game kind of looks like, and then putting your harvester in a place where it can be utilized again. I even have students that I coach on a regular basis where it's too much multitasking for them to put it on a tower and then have the awareness to pull it off the tower when something's coming after them. Usually they just lose it there. So kind of manage yourself in the sense that if you have the ability and the speed to say, well, here comes something, you got to pull it off the tower, and then go stash it in a mid-game scouting position, then do that. But if you can't, then just put it there preemptively. But too often do I see people either scout and then just lose the scout because they just stopped looking at it and it just died to whatever came out, or they scout and then head right back home. And specifically from the Protoss perspective, I know that that to be not optimal.
Makes you cry a little bit every time you see it.
A little bit, yeah.
I think what you said is actually really important. You know, from a casting perspective, anytime
I think Jeff just said
you see
everything totally applies.
You must have been a little lag there. Every time you see a unit go off to the side, kind of hide in those little pockets in various maps and stuff, you know, you can always just hone in on that they want to get that information later on. So we do get lots of, you know, lots of questions about scouting, and I guess specific instances, as this guy said, very, very nice to have. But there's at least some initial thoughts on it. For all those guys that are out there asking about it, we appreciate it. And now let's go ahead, and if Battle.net had email, you could send questions to itg@onemoregame.tv. And I actually want to read probably one of my favorite questions, and no, I'm not saying that just because it's Zerg, because I think I found myself asking this question before while watching a GSL match or even casting, and In Control and I you know, talked very, very, you know, little about this last night because I wanted to get, of course, Idris' perspective on it. But this question comes in from Jonathan. And Jonathan says, I've noticed that almost all Zerg players prioritize air attack upgrades for Mutalisks, often going 2-0. I found that in every engagement, Mutalisks are receiving damage, even if it's only minor damage from a single turret or four Marines, and the armor upgrade significantly improves Mutalisks' survivability. Of course, I put that's his opinion in there. So because Mutalisks because Mutalisks tend to overkill their target when focus firing, and Marine turrets have a fast rate of fire, I don't notice any significant change in damage output. Okay, we'll comment on that site separately. Up to now, I've only seen two pro players go armor first on Mutalisks, Leenok Fonu and MVP Dongregu. So which air upgrade do you think is more important? Are there any situations where you choose one upgrade over the other? And what about other units? We'll start with the Zerg, but other units, you know, like Vikings we see occasionally, a plus one, you know, how that might factor in with Corruptors. And it is true. Like, for the most part, we see air attack for Mutalisks. Idra, do you want to comment on this from, you know, a Zerg perspective? And
when I'm playing Muta Heavy, I always get a weapon upgrade, in part because it's cheaper, but mainly because basically Mutas are not meant to be fighting units, in that you're not going to be fighting close battles where you can just barely have Mutas survive when they wouldn't if they didn't have the armor upgrade. They are weak caress units. You're going around trying to deal damage and actually avoiding a fight where you'll take damage. So it seems to me that the plus one weapon upgrade is a lot more beneficial in that you'll kill buildings faster, you'll pick off stray units faster, and stuff like that. But when you are headed towards Hive, your end goal is Broodlord Corruptor Infester, something like that, then you should definitely be getting Carapace upgrades because it's just so incredibly effective against Thors and Vikings because they have volley attacks. That's it.
Okay.
What about the bounce? How does the glaive work on the bounce?
Yeah.
Does each bounce? I don't think each bounce gets an additional plus one. It's like a factor, right?
I think they still take the fractions and round it or something, but I know it can affect them. I just have
that also is a bonus for attack right there.
Yeah.
If each bounce gets an attack bonus.
I mean, in reality, you know, is there any situation where you would ever find yourself, I need to go armor? Because I really don't think I've seen anyone ever go that
think,
way.
I don't think with Terran, unless you're like dead set on going BCs, which you don't ever really see.
But you would occasionally get like a plus one Viking versus like a Protoss?
Plus one weapons? Absolutely. But Vikings are the type of unit, oftentimes you're either going to be going up against Colossus or Carriers, but you hardly ever see Carriers, or you're going to be going up against Broodlords. So they're super expensive units that you're going to be dealing with. Well, your opponent's units are super expensive, and you're just basically, you want to kill them as fast as you possibly can, because Broodlords and Colossus are devastating. So, I mean, it just makes all the sense in the world to get the attack upgrade. And they have double attack, so...
Right. I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer right there. In control, any thoughts on this? I know you use mutas all the time.
I used mutas back in Brood War. And just in those days, you used to get armor upgrade, but that was because you were looking for more stand-up fights than you do in StarCraft 2. I feel like they're the threshold for your mutas actually engaging the Terran, like in a straight-up stand-up fight, is much, much later. Just because the Thor's area of effect and the fact that Marines are such a mainstay in this matchup that it's very common for them to be getting upgraded much faster than the Zerg. So you're never going to have double... I mean, well, okay, I've seen it a couple times. You're most likely not going to have double Spire upgrading air units. So you're going to get one, maybe two upgrades for your mutas. And for the reasons that Idris said, typically attack is the one that you want because... It's much better to be able to hit three missile turrets at a fresh new base and trash the base in seconds than it is to last longer against a squad of Marines, you know.
All right. Well, thank you, Jonathan. David has a question for Idra and then for all. Idra, we all know that you guys check out your replays to improve your play, but do you guys ever go back and watch a cast of yourself? He says, you know, after a really good game, to relive it a bit, to savor the victory, so to speak. Have you ever been guilty of doing that, Idra?
Yeah, I've watched casts of myself. Not really just if I thought it was a good game or something. Just if I happen to... A lot of times I watch NASL during dinner or whatever. And so I'll see my game if it happens to be on a Sunday. And I usually watch all of the GSL games with a Zerg in it, myself included, just to see if I had missed anything like that my opponent did while I was playing. Stuff like that. So, yeah, I don't go out of my way to watch them, but I don't avoid them either.
Jeff?
I'm actually probably the biggest culprit of this ever. If I beat someone good or it's a good game, that replay gets saved. It gets transferred around. It gets documented for all of eternity. I love those things.
You're a data pack rat?
Not as bad as I used to be. It used to be that I'd save them just to keep record of what my win-loss was against people, which was like the epitome of egotistical, but now I just save cool games. And I do enjoy, I just love this game so much that if it's a cool game, especially if I win it, I love to watch it.
Well, I mean, I would expect that, dude. I mean, if I ever win a StarCraft II match, I'm going to definitely go back and watch that and go, oh my God, this is all. I can't imagine with a caster, you know. I'll get here as we go over to Pain User. You know, I want to think back to like one of the first MLG games that you had played. or at least that I had commentated. And you had this epic map or matchup. It was on Kulos Ravine when I guess that map was still played. It did some ridiculous shit with some Hellions. And, like, I could imagine that would be a game you'd go back and totally watch.
Yeah, I have watched that game a couple times. But only for me, it's more like games like that where you had, like, a really sensational feeling of victory, or you did something really cool, or even if it's a game that I've lost, if like my opponent did something really cool but it was like super close, I'll save games like that too. Like I have like a little special trunk where I keep all my cool replays like that.
And also his dead bodies, but we don't talk about that too much. And this kind of then goes into, this is a second question he has. He says he admits to not knowing that much about StarCraft 1, but I know there are some monsters, and he lists Flash and Stork. And he says, do you think these extremely dominant players have already emerged in StarCraft 2? Are we at that stage yet, or are we just, too early in the game? And I know this kind of might be a weird question to answer from a player's perspective, because every player should think that they're the best player on earth. You know, I mean,
should they though?
I don't know. I kind of think you got to have some confidence, brother.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Brother. But
looking old, Hogan Wheat.
Well, I mean, then tell me, what do you think, Pain User? Since you spoke up, do you think that do you think these dominant forces have arrived? And I'm talking about in relation to some of those same dominant forces that we've seen in other games. StarCraft 1 or whatever.
I mean, I think the game is definitely still too young for any player to be, like, considered Bonjour status or have established a dynasty or anything like that. But I don't know. Once we start seeing, you know, like, 3-4-time NASL champions, 3-4-time IPL champions, then for sure. But I don't think that, first off, I don't think that there's enough money in it yet to foster the kind of competition that would warrant granting anybody that kind of status. That's for sure.
Just because, wait, you're talking about just like from a winnings perspective?
No, I'm talking about the level of competition that kind of money fosters.
Okay. So
it's on a whole nother
I don't know, dude. I don't know if I can totally agree with that.
Well, no, like I think what he's saying is if Stork or Flash or Jadon came over,
yes.
Even if Nesty is currently a bone draw of StarCraft 2,
yes.
If one of those players switched over, then like 2 weeks later they'd beat him.
Okay.
So it seems weird saying that.
Okay. That's
pretty much exactly what I was saying. I was just trying to like explain it without saying that, I guess.
Okay. No. I just would say I would disagree if you were saying that basically, well, like players aren't giving it their all because there's not just
no.
It there. But you're just saying
that, the level of competition that they play at is just a whole different level. Like to call someone the Flash of SC2, it's like, no, have Flash play SC2 for 2 weeks and there's Flash playing SC2, like dominating the quote unquote Flash of SC2. I mean, I don't think people understand, like, just how good they really are.
In control, do you agree with this statement? I mean, in some aspects, I'm sure that the current any player would hear that and go, well, that's kind of crappy, you know?
I mean, certainly if Flash, Jadon, and Stork, some of these guys were to come over, they'd be fantastic. I don't think anyone would ever doubt that. But would they instantly solve the game and be the best ever?
No.
I would say no. It would take quite a lot of time. It's a very, very different game. It's a very, very, very different skill set. And I think they'd you know, be extremely ahead of the game, and they'd have limitless potential and limitless talent. So certainly they would push the threshold of the game. But we've had, like, people are quick to forget, like, July was a Golden Mouse winner, man. He was not some terrible Korean. And he actually was, like, 500 record-wise for the longest time. He was quite terrible when he came over. Nada, one of the historical best players ever to play StarCraft. He is great, but he hasn't solved the game. He's not taking down GSLs, and the list goes on. I mean, people are quick to point out, yeah, but MC and ST, some of these guys, they didn't have the most illustrious StarCraft Brood War career. I don't think that necessarily correlates. I don't think that necessarily trains. It's a good indicator of success if you're a betting person or if you're going to go off of paper. then these are the indications we look for. You don't want to be like, well, his mom was able to be a chess master, which in my, you know, like, you don't look at those weird things. You look at the more close correlations. But I disagree, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
I feel like J-Dong and Flash are like a new generation and new breed, though, like even beyond July Zerg and Nada and players like that. I mean, they were like super dominant in their time, in their heyday, absolutely. But I feel like J-Dong and Flash are just a completely different monster.
I don't know. You know, there was recently a lot of discussion on this in an article, and it's hard for me to just imagine that because it's a completely different game that we won't see that one dominant person come out that's not necessarily one of these individuals that you've thought about. I think another thing is that
we will know. Like, we wouldn't be, like, having this conversation if those players had already emerged in StarCraft II, right? I feel like we would just know.
I would totally agree with that statement, Pain User. I would absolutely agree with that. I don't know if your other two co-hosts would. Would we know, Indra? Is it you?
I don't really think we're going to have a bunch on StarCraft II. I think there's too much volatility in the game. I think if you look at the people who are really incredibly dominant, and I think Flash and J-Dong and maybe Beast, who were the only ones who really contended for it in the last 5 years, and that was all through mechanical superiority. StarCraft II is a much more strategical game, and it's really hard to hold that kind of win percentage with a game like that, just because there's always going to be a certain amount of luck in the scouting and the strategic aspect of it. You can't just simply outplay them and give your opponent absolutely no option to win. Like, you simply cannot have more units than Flash or better control than Flash. That doesn't change no matter what. But if he goes 2-effect and you know it's coming, then you can counter it and all other variations on that. So I think StarCraft 2 is a lot more volatile, and I'll be kind of surprised if we do actually have a true bone troll in with it.
Does, as someone who had such a large investment in both Brood War and now StarCraft 2, does that make you sad, or are you okay with that?
No, definitely. Just because that's the kind of player I am. I'm a very mechanical player, and I love seeing the better player rewarded. And really, I value mechanical skill, as the person with better mechanics is a better player. So, no, personally, I found it disappointing, but it's just a different style of game. I can understand it.
Sure. Okay. All right. Any final thoughts on that? And if not, we're going to go ahead and jump into the phones. Our 45 minutes is up, and we got probably about a billion people that want to call in. All right.
Done for me.
I'm going to take that as a no. All right. In Control's favorite part of the show.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. Definitely Indra's favorite part. Pain User, I'm not sure if he likes it. Sign for the help desk where you can call. I don't know. Do you enjoy it?
Yeah, it's awesome.
Okay. You can Skype us at DJ Wheat or via telephone 909-581-8519. If you for the one guy who's like, I wish that silver level guys would stop giving questions to these guys, yeah, feel free, itg@onemoregame.tv, send it in. We'd love to hear your question, and we'll take our make sure we're equipped here. We'll take our first caller right here. We got area code 864. Welcome to Inside the Game. What's up?
Hi. I have a question for Idra.
Okay.
Hello.
Yes.
Why are you such a fucking
awesome guy? Why don't you tell us? Why don't you tell us why you are such a fucking awesome guy, Idra? Let's hear it.
I don't know.
Yeah. What is up?
Thanks a lot, buddy. Thanks a lot, dude. That was awesome.
You know what? When you're like, hello, it's kind of going to be a no-brainer. All right. We probably have...
This is like, what, four? We've done this? Three?
Yeah. Yeah.
The first one.
He tried, dude. He tried.
Dude, I'm just
going to
go ahead and throw this out there. Like, for all those people that, like, forum troll about Greg and stuff and, like, get all, like, think he's, like, a total dick and, like, all this shit... His little in-game persona. He's actually a really cool guy in real life, so piss off.
Good job.
It's true. People have such a like retarded misconception about him. It's I don't know, it's retarded.
One day we'll let him you know, just go off about that. But I think we have, like, your guys' number one fan on the phone right now. We've got Elaine's son. What is up?
Hey. I'm so happy to finally get my call in. I sit for, like, 20 minutes every time with the dial tone. Anyway, so I just wanted to ask everybody, what is the most satisfying win you have ever had in StarCraft history, whether it's on ladder or a show match or a tournament? Tell us about it.
Adria?
I don't know. That game versus Druby when I ended it with Neural Parasite on like 8 or 9 Thors in IPL was pretty awesome.
How do I know you better? How do I know you better than you?
Oh, Huck. No, I'm sure I'm forgetting something. Oh, Huck. That's true. Okay.
You beat Huck. That was, you were actually like on Cloud9.
Up on stage on MLG. Yeah. I was
every
so
interview.
I didn't care about getting Proxy 2 reacts by TLO the next game. Yeah. That was a pretty
out.
Good win.
You weren't even mad because you beat Huck.
I remember watching Indra walk from the featured stage and kind of be like, yeah, you know, it's all good.
I don't
Everyone's
care yet.
Like, no, oh, it's over.
Sorry, what?
Everyone at the event was like, oh, what? TLO and Idra is over already? We're so confused.
It was over.
Yeah, it was like 2 5-minute games, so it was pretty cool.
All right, paid user, what about you? Nope. Okay, in control.
go ahead.
Definitely the best series with Tyler.
Wow.
I got to showcase a new build that I had been working on for a really long time, and it was awesome.
Wait, I didn't hear what you said because it was kind of like, what was the actual match?
I think I heard versus Tyler.
Okay, I don't know when, but all right.
He beat Tyler for 3rd, 4th place, I believe, of MLG 2000.
Am I still lagging out?
Yeah, well, you come back and then you're fine. And then you're going. So, it control, quickly,
Taylor,
how about you?
MLG, right? He's typing.
Yeah, he's. We're just going to let him stay in stasis there. In control, what about you?
For me, it was probably the TLO win at MLG 2011, just because I lost the first 2 games of that extended series. So... the whole tournament kind of represented for me my ability to compete with some of these people and place highly in a tournament, which is a huge monkey off my back because I did that in Brood War. But in StarCraft II, it's been pretty disappointing so far. I've had okay placements, but I don't want to just be an okay StarCraft II player, especially not for how much time and energy and love and blood and all that shit I put into this game. So to beat TLO in a long series like that when everything is on the line, felt really, really good.
Felt good casting it, so thank you for those games. Pain user, are you with the current timeline status quo? That's so awesome. All right, thanks. Thanks a lot for your call. Take care.
Bye.
All right, beautiful. We're going to put up the noodle girl for... Noodles are crazy, and so is Pain User. So, yeah, we got a little issue with that call. We'll just go ahead and take the next caller. We've got Sam on the line. Sam, welcome to Inside the Game. What's up? Hello, Sam. Don't do this to me, Sam. Sam, don't listen. Bye, Sam.
Lost him.
Bye, Sam. All right, we got area code 469 on the line. Welcome to Inside the Game. What's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Doing awesome. What's up?
Not much. Hey, Idra, I had a question for you, man.
Yeah.
I see that you're living in Korea. Has, you know, outside of the game, has Korea, just the culture in general, affected any part of your lifestyle or any of your gameplay, anything like that? And do you miss your home life?
Well, I'm back in the U.S. now. But while I was in Korea... It affected my game in that I was living in a Korean house with a bunch of Koreans, and at that time you couldn't really get that outside of Korea. But the culture, no, the culture didn't affect my game at all. Although it obviously affects your living conditions a lot. You don't speak the language that everyone else speaks, and just it is a very, very different culture. So yeah, but no, the game itself, it was only affected by the fact that I was living in a team house.
the strict kimchi diet didn't have some sort of amazing effect on your...
No, believe it or not, no.
You don't
maybe the Korean barbecue.
Do you like kimchi?
Korean barbecue is amazing.
I kind of like forced myself to like it because I wanted to eat a side dish, and that seemed like a logical one to go with. It's okay. Cucumber kimchi is better,
nothing.
Though.
It's
cucumber
lettuce
kimchi's really good.
In some weird sauce.
I feel you, Jeff.
Some weird sauce.
that wouldn't sustain me for more than an hour.
I know.
Like a bowl.
All right.
Jeff, want some kimchi? Like,
thank
no,
you. Thank you, caller, for that one. I saw a call pop up here. I'll never be able to find it, but it is David Kim. I'm sure that one's a totally legit question for you guys. We'll grab that one next. Let me grab this one. We got area code 502 on the line. Welcome to Inside the Game. What's up?
What's up?
Not much, man. What's up?
Do I just give you my name or what? Like, that's it?
What's that?
So do I just give you my name?
Yeah, you tell us who you are, tell us what race you play, and then go ahead and throw out your question for our hosts.
All right, my name's Adam, play Zerg, and my question is going to be for Idra. I'm wondering if he's going to, when he wins MLG Columbus, if he's going to go back to Korea and play in the Code S.
If I get the Code S spot, there's like a tiny, tiny possibility, but no, I doubt it. There's just too much going on outside Korea. I can't afford to sacrifice a month to go back to Korea. For something like that. And I definitely wouldn't take one of the Code A spots.
Alright, well, I want to hang out with you at Columbus, so I'm looking forward to meeting you, buddy. I'll talk to you later.
Alright,
sounds good.
Thanks a lot. Thanks. Oh, I hung up on him before I told him that it was going to be $50 an hour to do that. Shit.
50?
50,000, you mean? Wait, no, I'm just playing. All right, we'll take this one. We've got Feng on the line. Feng, welcome to Inside the Game. What is up?
Hey, guys. Let me mute the stream for one sec.
Okay, that'd be great.
All right. Okay, so I got a question. I promise I'm not trolling here, but a lot of recent big tournaments, Europeans have been dominating. Where's America at? You know, how come we're losing to them?
I mean, there's some, you know, decent question here. But let me ask you this: can you define in the last major tournaments, like just what is going through your head when you say that?
An example I have is TSL, right?
Okay.
Like top four is European, I think.
Okay, I mean, we could say MLG Dallas as well. I just wanted to, you know. It's a broad statement, so
when I speak to European friends of mine about it, a lot of them say that it boils down to the fact that they have so many different tournaments going on. Like, there's so much going on, especially online tournaments that almost all the good players participate in. So they get a lot of experience playing against one another in a competitive match setting and in a tournament setting, and they all try really, really hard. So,
I mean, are you talking like the weekly cups main user, or are you talking about
they
like,
play in everything? They play in the weekly cups, and then they have like more like large cash sum tournaments than we do. So yeah, I think that's partly a big reason, and then also it seems just like it's, you always see like the same guys like in the European scenes, like a big crew that all play together a lot, and they're doing very well in the IPL qualifiers as well. I mean, it's like 50-50 European American right now, but in terms of applicants, it's like 25% European, 75% American, so they're really pulling weight.
What do you guys think?
Well, I don't know. Well, as for that IPL example, I don't really like looking at the number of signups because there's only a group of like 20 people who are actually vying for the spots.
Yeah, that's
realistically.
True. Yeah, yeah.
And so I don't know what the percentages are amongst like top Americans versus top Europeans, but if 50-50 qualifiers, I think that actually it's a pretty decent representation of the fact that Americans are doing okay. But I don't know. I don't follow foreign results all that much besides my game, so it's hard for me to commentate. Like, I do feel Europeans are a little bit better, but like Kiwikaki or Select, any of the EG guys, most of the rest of the Root guys certainly compete with any top European. I think some of us are better than most of them, so I don't think there's a whole lot of merit to that.
You think the skill gap is maybe closer than what Fang is kind of...
At the very top. The North American server, like the latter, is awful compared to European. Like, it's a lot worse.
I think Europe has more top players, but I don't think that their top players are any better than the top North American players. Kiwetaki, Select, Idra being the highest echelon. They win and do well in just about every tournament. And then the tier below that, yeah, they do fairly well. But Europe has, I would say, like Naniwa, Thor, Zane, White Raw,
Show,
perhaps the Muslim could be considered up there. These some of these other players, Straylock is doing fantastically well. They have, I would say, two or three times more players that are capable of turning out the results that our top three or four players can. And I don't necessarily think that that has anything to do with, like, more tournament opportunities or anything like that. It's just that they're putting in the time. Unfortunately, one of our top players in, like, even if you take Tyler as an example, he doesn't really play. He doesn't really practice. And we lost a lot from Brood War 2. A lot of our top players didn't translate over. Like, Skew is kind of serious about it, but not necessarily. G5's non-existent.
Okay.
Artosis is a full-time caster now. The list kind of goes on and on. So, for whatever reason, I think the top North American players are fewer, and the European ones, they're retaining a lot more of them.
Also, the European Warcraft 3 players are doing
really
well.
Warcraft 3, yep, that's exactly what I was going to say. They've always had a Warcraft 3 scene, and their Warcraft 3 players are translating to Starcraft 2 very, very well. So they have more people to choose from, in my opinion. The North American Warcraft 3 scene was like Sonki.
It's like non-existent.
Axelav, you know, Stripe Crow, kind of, and then Long Walk or something like that. You know, like, that's it. Scream.
Wizard. And his pants.
Yep.
Oh, God, I totally saw that guy at CPL one year.
Wizard, come on.
You know what, though? To expound on that guy's point, North American players have more character and personality than all the European players. Where are they at on that? I mean, Avilo? Come on. We even got the princess.
It's true. Okay.
That's what I'm thinking. That's all I'm saying. Where's Europe on that?
Okay. Formerly known as Princess. That should be his...
I have to agree with Ink Control here. I mean, there's definitely more personality in the North American players than I think we get out of the, you know, and actually it's almost,
well, it's a good thing we're not having a personality contest.
Well, you're right. You're right, pain user. But
you know what's gonna
as everyone up? Hold on, yeah, as everyone chases this dream and is like, we need StarCraft on TV and shit, be like, you know, guess what, guys? There will come a point where, as it reaches the mainstream, people care about that. People are fans of you guys because of your personality. You know, sometimes that personality actually is totally different. Let's take Naniwa. And his lack of personality gave him a personality for people to like. I mean, Naniwa actually has a great... But, like, in his interview on stage at the end of MLG... He's just like, yeah, 120 games.
It was okay.
It was cool. And everyone's like, oh, man, Naniwa, he's like so chill. And it gave them another reason to just love the guy. So I think personality is a big deal. It's not a personality contest, but it's still a big deal.
I think in that category, we're kicking the shit out of Sweden.
All right, thanks for your call, dude.
Thanks for having me.
All right. well, at least we're winning in one of the apartments. We'll take this call right here. We're going to have Daniel on the line. Daniel, welcome to Inside the Game.
Hi, guys. This is Cyrex. I'm a silver player, but I have...
But...
Drop the call.
He tailored it.
You have problems with your mic.
Sorry, I'm playing with my microphone.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. What's up?
I have a question about the structure placement for each races. I know Zerg doesn't have as many unit-producing structures, but Terran, I find that I have more issues in endgame with finding good places to add extra barracks and things like that. was just wondering how much thought do you put into your building placement mid game into late game?
Taylor.
Did we lose?
Generally, you're thinking about it all game, but once you get experience, like, you just want to streamline all your production and reduce as much clutter as possible. And I think it's particularly important with Terran because you have so many buildings and so many add-ons, and you do fill a lot of that like viable building space, especially on a map like Zelnaga, where you just have such a small main base. And you also don't want to keep your buildings near the wall either, especially in Terran versus Terran, because you don't want your production line to get sieged. So you have to think about it ahead of time. Streamline your buildings. I like to make vertical sets of production buildings. So, like, you know, maybe two vertical sets of racks, mix a factory in there, something like that. And that tends to save a lot of room, and your production is streamlined. So your units are coming right out and heading to the front of your ramp immediately without any clutter. You probably want to use supply depots, like in an off area where you wouldn't be putting production, you know, around the mineral line, near one of your geysers, something like that. Also using them to block behind your mineral line so you can raise them up and down in the event that, like, Hellions or, you know, some type of harass unit gets back there, speedlings, whatever. And then against Zerg, it's not usually a problem because you use a lot of your production buildings to kind of wall off different segments of the map, wall off your natural, especially on a map like Zelnaga as well in TVZ. Like, you can put Raxes to wall off the different sections of your natural, and then you can also use Raxes to wall off a portion of mid, so there's not nearly as much clutter in your main base, and you can free up that space for factories and stuff like that.
Is that anything that you consciously practice on new maps?
In terms of building placement?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Going into a new map, like, sometimes you can just start up a game, like, against the computer on easy or whatever and just go up to 200 supply and just kind of, like, map out where you would put all of your individual buildings and just try and think of it like whenever you drop a building with Terran, like, you might as well use it in a beneficial spot, you know? Like, supply depots can be great for walling. Raxes are great for walling. So anytime you can use one of those buildings in a situation like that, you might as well do it. I mean, you're not hurting yourself. And then also, like, bunker positioning is also really important, too. Like, you can do all kinds of cute stuff if you actually practice out where to put your buildings at your natural, because you can even wall off for your bunkers if you leave the proper space between the command center and the wall.
Okay.
All right. Stack setups on different maps, and even new building setups on maps I already know.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, man. All right. And I'm sure that, you know, as if you watch some of the pro games, you know, we were commenting on some of the pro DOS and the way they'd do some nice building in the back of their lines to do exactly the kind of things that you said you were doing with supply depots and the like. So, good call. We'll take...
Yeah, Kiwi Cocky is, like, a particularly good player at that.
Yeah. I think that's who we were watching last night, who we were kind of commenting.
Yeah.
All right, you ready for David really Kim? Good. He apparently wants to call in. He wants to hear your thoughts on...
Stumming for Greg.
On, you know, and it could be... David Kim's a pretty common name. So,
Don't get racist on us, Weed.
We got David Kim on the line. Welcome to Inside the Game. What's up?
Hey, man. What's up? I got a quick question for pretty much everyone. Like, I'm watching Idris stream a lot, and, like, he always pretty much gets bad-mannered by, like, kids like Deezer. I've seen him play Deezer, like, 10 times. And, like, I don't know, with kids like that who bad-manner you, like, would evil geniuses ever, like, get a kid like that on their team? No, right?
Like, oh, they were good. Why not?
Is Deezer good, Idra?
No. Fucking awful.
To take back the spirit of your question, I think, because I actually like where you're going with this, because I have actually taken the time, and by taking the time, I mean I've completely wasted it. I've communicated to a few of these people, because I get this a lot, too, that even if you are good, if you have a big breakout tournament, if you do really well, the fact that you... It's the proverbial you, by the way, Mr. David Kim. I'm not singling you out, but these guys that go around and act like jerks, they're going to get less opportunities, they're going to get overlooked more often, and they're going to be treated worse just because they went out of their way to be a pain in the ass to everyone. It just right. it's a good life lesson that you should just be good as a policy. You should be kind. You should be positive. You'll get more opportunities that way. If you get to a place where you're hugely successful and you your skills can do some of the talking for you, then you can afford to say stupid things all the time, like Greg does. But otherwise, it's only going to hold you back. There's no, like, there won't be a school of Idra 10 years down the road where he's like, listen, if you want to get that job, tell them they're a cheesy fucking newbie and laugh in their face, and then you'll just get the job, I promise you. It's just not going to happen.
It does burn – it can burn personal bridges, especially when it's like that where he's just purely being a douchebag personally, like insulting other players directly, stuff
yeah,
like that.
Absolutely.
But, no, I mean, you ask Sir Scoots or whatever, a lot of people complain to him about them hiring me. He just laughs at them. It's like, obviously, that doesn't matter relative to winning tournaments. So it doesn't – it's not going to hold him out of the community if he actually gets good, but it could make things harder for him.
But also, it's different too. Let's not paint Greg with the same brush that this random guy is. Like,
yeah,
it's not just that Greg wins tournaments. It's also that he doesn't go into a game and start yelling at somebody that they're an asshole unless there's some kind of weird history there previously. 9 times out of 10, you're either venting anger because you just lost, or they started it, right? Like, or you have some history. I guess is the obscure number 3. So you're not the same as them, and in that sense, I don't want this to be construed as like Idra can say whatever the hell he wants and does. He does it because it's like that's your personality, but there's usually a reason.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody was going to misconstrue that about Greg from the conversation.
Dude, listen, Taylor, just take my word on this. Anything is possible when it comes to believing that shit.
And then another thing is, like, you might have to watch out for your personal safety at some point, because honestly, like, if I ever saw Combat EX at a LAN tournament, I would punch him in the face so hard.
I'd be on the other side. You'd hit his front, I'd hit his back.
But so then you have to live in
constant your back anonymity, too.
Right? So if he ever came to a LAN tournament, he couldn't represent who he actually is. So that's a downside too.
Yeah, I definitely have your back on that.
Yeah, I'd like to watch that YouTube video right there.
Oh my god!
All right,
he will. He's like kind of good enough too to. Jeff,
he's done a lot of stuff before. Like,
he's a grandmaster, is he?
He went to one of those Toronto LAN thingies, and he was actually the same way in real life. Like, he hid pylons in the game on stage and shit.
Jeff, we'd have to like do some sort of WWE like tag team thing before some big like chest bump, and then just like.
I make no mistake about it. Like, it's not like I'm so mature that like I don't like you, so I'm gonna hit you when I see you. But like.
He crosses the line.
You say, yeah, exactly. If you hack and steal money from people maliciously and then you don't apologize about it, you just like do it, you're a thief to me. You should get your ass beat. If you like threaten someone, I've been threatened to get knifed, and I was like, okay, please remind me the next time I see you that you're going to try to knife me. I'd love for the opportunity to have that exchange, you know, like. There are times where the nerd community has chosen warriors where it's like, I'm sorry, you can't just be an online hero. If you think you want to go to a LAN and everyone will forget about it, you're wrong.
All right, caller, thanks a lot, David Kim.
No problem. Thanks, guys.
Yep, keep up.
Yeah,
that,
good question.
I've only witnessed, I think, one physical altercation at a LAN event, and it was... because of a player
CBO?
That was no, actually the one where I'm talking about, like, I saw fist fly and there was some blood and there was some and it was actually at ESWC. It was like in 2004, 2005. And there's a guy, his name was Infinite, and he was a jackass. He was the Combat X of Unreal Tournament, you guys. And actually he got into it with Too Good. And Two
guys are like the nicest person I've ever met.
Oh, man. So you can imagine what, you know, imagine like kind of like the way that, you know, Jeff is saying it about this or that. It was the same kind of thing. Like, you're right. Two Good's a really nice guy. It took a lot to set him off. Two Good kind of popped him in the face, and that was going to be the end of that. So,
yeah.
But, I mean, it's true. No, I only seen it one time, so thank goodness for that.
It's a life lesson, man. It
is.
There's no difference when you play like on a football field. I've had to bop some nerds, man. Like, kid says a racial slur to me, I'm sitting right there. I'm not gonna just let it go. And I definitely broke this kid's hand into pieces. It was very, very good. He won't be.
I definitely feel like after an experience like that too, because I feel like a lot of these people who do that kind of stuff, they first of all, they have the security of internet anonymity, like 100% relying on that, and they just don't deal with like real life situations with people like this in their life. So it just really takes one time for somebody to like stand up to them and be like, hey, like, this isn't the way you act, this isn't the way you treat people in real life, like, stop. And if they keep doing it, just takes one time, and I'm pretty sure Combat X just would probably be like a pretty normal, pretty nice guy after like a quick run-in.
Whether people are listening to this and going, you're crazy because it's the internet, I cannot agree more. You know, like, I, you know, make no mistake, I'm an older dude. You know, I still come from an old camp. I realize that it's the dawn of the internet. I'm with it. I'm down. I get it, you know. But,
well, dude, it's only a matter of time until somebody invents the machine that lets you punch somebody through the
mouth. Oh, God. Right?
Once that comes around, then it's the best invention of the century.
Could you imagine what you just described there? If that was a Jeopardy question, the answer would be like, what is the greatest day for Greg Idrefields ever? When suddenly some guy is like, Greg, would you like to beta test this new technology where you can punch people through the monitor? He'd be like,
it'd be amazing.
Install it right here. That'd be great.
You'd have to have like a 16-ounce red punching glove to the right of your monitor, like automatically installed, and then like whoever wins the StarCraft game can choose whether or not to like push a smack him in the face button. If you ever get BM'd, you can just win and then smack him in the face.
I like it. Let's take a couple more of these, and then we'll go ahead and we'll wrap up for the night. We're going to take this one right here. We've got Steven on the line. Steven, welcome to Inside the Game.
Hi.
Hello.
My question is for Idra. And it's about the conversation he had with Day 9 about Zerg not having any safe builds. And I'm a Masters level player. I consider myself okay, but, you know, I still lack basic understanding of the game, I think. And from my perspective, I think that the Zerg are kind of a reactionary race. And I thought that if they had a real safe build, due to their ability to just build one building and then have like 14 larva off of two hatches, don't you think a safe build would make it kind of overpowered because they could be safe all the time? And then it's kind of a risk versus reward is how I see the Zerg right now.
There were two parts of that argument. I said either Zerg needs to build a scout, in which case the reactionary race, the fact that it's a reactionary race, can kick in and you can react to what they're doing. Or you have to have a safe build such that you don't need to be able to scout in order to have a decent chance to get the mid-game in good shape. As is, yeah, you can react, but it's just usually not enough. Or you have to commit enough to defense in order to be able to react to anything that you still end up behind, unless you happen to get lucky. So, yeah, it is the reactive race. The problem is that without scouting, you can't react in time for it to really pay off. You can't sit around saving larvae when you're supposed to be building your economy, if they're building a nexus or something.
Okay, that's kind of what I meant about the risk versus reward portion of it. And I was just wondering, how do you see the scouting difference from Zerg as to Protoss for scouting your opponent?
Protoss doesn't need to scout nearly as much. They have more of an all-purpose build. If you go Warp Gate Expand, then you're in pretty good shape versus anything, as long as you hit your force fields versus the Roachling all-in.
Okay, so it's not that Protoss can scout better, it's just they don't need to.
Within reason and within the early game, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Steven. All right, we'll take a couple more. I see that our good buddy Goatless is trying to call in, but I'm going to save him for last. I'm saving for last.
Hello, mates.
He's going to be the water skiing squirrel today again on Inside the Game. That's right. All right, we're going to take Joey's call here. Joey, welcome to Inside the Game, live from a blizzard. What's up? It's getting worse out there. The tornado's hitting. All right, Joey, you tried to call an all show, and that's what happens. All right, take another one then. Fire Silver, welcome to Inside the Game. What's up?
Hey, DJ. Hello. Yeah, it's good to be here. Yeah, I was basically have a question for In Control. I was basically wondering about warp prisms, because basically I did ask Huck the same question, and he said they were kind of fragile, but they could definitely be used in PBT. I was wondering if, like, because a lot of people said about buffing them, if that would be a good idea or not.
We actually talked about this last week. In Control actually talked a lot about warp prisms.
Yeah, I mean, your question is, do they need a buff? I don't necessarily think so. I mean, the ability to create a warp field, a mobile warp field is hugely powerful. I think it's just underutilized, so certainly we'll see more of that. And I think you do need to have the fragility of the warp prism to kind of make sure that that has a risk to reward element to it. If it's able to tank damage, then it becomes, I feel like, one of the strongest drop options in the game. And I don't think Protoss needs necessarily the strongest drop option in the game. So I'm pretty okay with how they are. Especially with the speed upgrade, they become actually heinously, heinously good. It's just that people don't use them, so we haven't seen that much of them.
Okay. Huck also said that he thinks they're much more valuable in PVT. So kind of question for everybody. Would you agree with that? Because I always thought that PVZ would be much, much better for warp prisms.
No. Speaking from a Terran perspective, like, your units are way slower. If you're using siege tanks, like if you're pushing the Protoss base and he sneaks into warp prism through the back and warps like four zealots into your mineral line, not to mention you have to wait for your production cycles. So like depending on where your units are queued at in the racks, they can deny mining time for so much. And if you're not paying attention, they can even kill like a ton of SCVs. I don't think it's and then also if you're waiting below your ramp with units, they can bring like a force field, two zealots and a stalker, and
I think you said a sentry more viable in PBT. So you're agreeing with him right now.
I think he was saying they were more viable in against.
He was saying a lot of people think it's better against Terran. Yeah. He personally thinks it's better for Zerg.
I think it's definitely better against Terran. Oh. Zerg units are so quick, and if they have a really good creep spread, like it's so easy for a Zerg to just quickly mobilize and deal with any, like if you start warping units into the Zerg main, it's so easy for them to just get back with their forces and deal with that. I feel like, I don't know, Greg, maybe you highlight that a little bit more.
No, I'd agree with, I think they are very good against Zerg, especially in certain situations. If you play really, really turtly and spread them out with warp prism, mostly DTs, harass all over, it's quite powerful. But I would definitely think it's better versus Terran. Just the TVP army is a lot less mobile in general. So yeah, I'd agree it's better versus Terran.
All right, thanks, guys.
What's up, Bryce?
All right, thank you, Fire Silver. Take care.
Hi.
We'll take a couple more calls since we did start a little bit late. let's take this one. We've got the unknown number. Hello, welcome to Inside the Game. Hello.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
They're using one of those phones that you like hang up the receiver. He's like a listening Go phone. To it one end, and he's speaking into the cone on the other end. And he has a rotary dial on it. And he finally got in, and he is failing. Good night. Let's take this one. We got Douglas on the line. Douglas, welcome to Inside the Game.
Hey, what's up?
What's up?
What up?
I'm a Protoss player. I got a question for In Control about PvP. So
here.
Yeah, so I've been really liking a kind of charge a lot of Archon mid-game in PvP lately since the patch. I think it's, like, really good. But I don't really like it off one base. I think it seemed pretty weak to me. So I'm wondering, what do you think is kind of the best opening tech option in order to get to that mid-game, like, in a stable way?
You know, I mean, the composition you speak about, just know that I'm going a little bit off the cuff. I've definitely commentated some games that's been used. I've toyed around with it some. But I'm not going to sit here and pretend to be some kind of huge zealot Archon master who's experimented with it to the levels of, you know, whatever. Just I'm fairly inexperienced with it. I would say that your best option heading in that direction would still be, I hate calling it this because he's such an idiot, but like an Adel Scott style, in the sense where you're very gateway unit-centric and you are upgrading heavily with your gateway units, because that way they scale to the higher, you know, the more advanced stages of the game with higher quality. If you're doing like Blink Stalker and then you fall back into Charge Lot Archon, that too is okay, and I think that's actually kind of the Adel Scott style, a variation of it, I would say. And that's much more popular. There's a lot of people that are doing that. The biggest thing I would say is that if you're going to do that style and you're going to expand and stuff, do consider expanding outside your natural and playing to the base trade style. So the second they leave their base, if they have Colossus or whatever, blink into their base and start trying to either egg them back on, or you're just going to straight up do a base trade. And the fact that you have a base away from your main means that you can kill their critical buildings and mortally wound them, and then come back and defend that final base, and hopefully have built up enough units to not only trade, but win the game.
Yeah, that's cool. I've actually been having some good success with like Phoenix opening too, because it shuts down the Colossus pretty hard, and then like you can get to two base off that, but
yeah,
it's kind of weak against Blink Stalkers, so I'm not sure.
Yep, and that's the same problem as I ran into. You know, I'm a huge proponent of the Phoenix in PvP. I think it's fantastic, but a lot more of these Protoss are moving towards Blink Stalker openings, which means that the Phoenix opening is becoming more and more risky, because I think you are behind against a Blink Stalker opening. So,
it means I've seen you transition to Phoenix like later on in PvP and do really well.
That's, well, in my opinion, that's the better way to do it, is to open up Standard and then transition into Phoenix. Because most players will funnel all their money into Colossus, and your 5 or 6 Colossus versus their 9 or 10 even are going to kill their anti-air, their Stalkers, that are already fewer in number. And then your Phoenix clean up their Colossus while you're still crushing them with more gateway units and Colossus. It's always better to have fewer Colossus, more gateway units, as long as you micro your army, because it takes them more shots to kill the gateway units, whereas your Colossus can focus down on theirs. So that's the kind of situations you're kind of shooting for, in my opinion.
Yep. All right, cool.
All right, thanks, Douglas. Take care. All right, since we have about 5 minutes left, let's go ahead and bring on our water skiing squirrel. And I know everyone's been waiting for it. So we have Goatlust on the line. Welcome, Goatlust, to Inside the Game.
Yeah, g'day, fellas.
G'day.
Yeah, this week I've decided to ask a bit of a question about builds and getting better. Now, I know a lot of you guys will generally say that if you're laddering and you're trying to get better, that you shouldn't really be going for 2-port Banshee every single fucking game. And like, I'm just wondering, you know, this is the sort of thing you could see on a TL strategy forum or something, but I know a lot of people would really prefer to hear it out of the mouths of, like, some really good players like you guys. What are the basic builds, like, you know, your safe builds, the things you want to be going to get your mechanics better in each matchup?
For me, anything that involves a CC early on in the game is probably something people could work off, like either a 1-Rax FE or a Rax Fact CC. Any kind of build that's centered around attempting to safely get a relatively early command center and take an economic lead and then working it from there. I mean, there's so many different variations on builds from there, but if there's one thing I would recommend on at least as Terran, is like learn how to not win base all the time. It's like so traditional.
All right. Pain user has fallen off the earth again.
Worse than the Aussie thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. In control, then your turn, and then pain user. Oh, there he's back. But
we're asking. You're asking specifically Terran, right?
No, I'm a Zerg player, so, you know, I just thought, you know, each matchup, like, you know.
Right.
what?
Well, I mean, you actually kind of you almost answered the question for yourself. It absolutely is just a much more robust slash rich learning experience. It's going to serve you in the long run a lot better if you learn the game safely. I can't tell you how many students come to me and they have just been four-gating up to diamond or platinum or something like that, and they're like, okay, now what do I do? And it's the opposite. I feel like you should work on the bread and butter strategy, so three-gate expand, two-gate robo PVT, two-gate robo PVP, those kind of generic openings that are better against more builds, because they put you in more situations where you're like, ah, crap, this didn't work, this did work, you know, this is what the late game looks like, this is what the mid game looks like, etc., as opposed to timing or all-ins or strategies based upon kind of hitting that one window of time where you either learn that, okay, it worked or it didn't work, but it's a shallow experience. I mean, there's certainly still educational benefits to be had from that, so I would never say don't ever all-in or don't ever cheese, but I would say that your percentile should look like 80 to 90% straight up and 10 to 15% cheese or timing, especially in your learning period of time. That can, of course, change when you get to be a competitive player. Sometimes you have to execute cheese or all-ins or whatever strategically for factors that are outside of learning the game. So it's different.
Yeah. For me, it just kind of, it echoes them, except it's a lot more so because Zerg is kind of a bit more fragile early game. Just no real attack, especially not Roach or Baneling focused attacks. Light Zergling pressure, just keep them honest sometimes, maybe. But generally, you're just going to go either 14 guess, 14 pool, or 15 hatch, 14 or 15 pool, and just try and play reactively and defensively, and build up your economy off that. Try and learn how to react to different scenarios. Yeah, aggression with Zerg is always going to be risky. Defensive economy is going to be safe. And people will look at recent games like the 10 towards Roachling all-in CVP. Those are very powerful, and it's good to do them right now because Protosses were being kind of greedy just because Zerg aggression does seem kind of weak. But it's not going to be a long-term thing. Protosses are going to start making that cannon, or they're just going to sit there holding the F button waiting to cast the first round of force fields, and then it's not going to work anymore. So generally, yeah, just defensive play, and the thing you really need to focus on is learning to react to what you see in your opponent.
Yeah. Could I also quickly ask, this is completely unrelated, but you know, I watch your games, Idra versus Sen, and then later Xenio. I mean, you were out of practice against Sen, I'm aware, but I was a little bit disappointed as an Idra fan watching those Xenio games. And you came into it thinking you were going to take the win. So what happened there?
I was behind him on ZVZ. You're just not allowed to attack anymore. Infestor Turtle into that late game Roach Hydra Infestor army is by far better than... I was still trying to make Roach timing attacks work, and you just can't. Infestor Turtle is the way to play ZVZ right now. And I didn't know that before.
Yeah.
Did you like that answer?
Go left. That's what I was looking for.
My biggest concern is, are you still Idris fan?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'm a Ninja fan, yeah.
All right, for sure. Just make it sure. Just make it sure. All right. Goatlust, it's a pleasure to end the show with you, sir.
Yeah, you're the man.
It's a real pleasure for me, too. So thank you very much, guys. Right.
Thank you, sir. You have a good one. Take care. Peace.
Take care.
Bye-bye. It was good. Well lasted. I can't even find his thing. I don't even know how to hang up with him.
Find it. Declose it, mate. Bad luck.
What? I honestly, like, I've got Goatlust on still, but I have no window to disconnect the call. So I guess that Goatlust...
Want me to end it, mate?
Well, I mean, unless you just, I mean, you know, if you want to be that nice guy, or right. You could take care. Look at that. What a decent guy he is. I've never had that happen before.
Yeah, I got a question for Idra. Why are you such a...
Of course, the first guy.
You got a quick trigger finger on that weight. That was impressive.
It's a lot, yeah. Lots of experience on that one.
Made me nervous, though, because everyone words it that way. Yeah, I got a question for you.
That's why I'm ready every time. You see, like, this is how the show is done right here with this one little thing, like, hovering over. No, it's not really that bad. You can usually tell. You can usually tell. It's the guys that come at you really intelligently, and like you feel like, wow, this guy's about to ask the greatest question. We had a guy one time in the early years of epileptic gaming called up. He's like, yeah, guys, so I really got this blah blah blah. He sets it up. He talks about how he's plays games all the time, blah blah. Then all of a sudden he's like, so really, what I want to know, and then you hear the toilet flush, and then he hangs up, and we're it's like, how do you stop it? How do you stop that? He got me.
It's pretty sneaky.
It is. Sneaky guy.
Made his day.
He probably did.
Passed around the office.
Even to this day, he's probably, I remember one time I flushed the toilet on DJ Wing Show. It was so great. You're like, that's an awesome
guys, look at this video I made.
If someone does that next week, I will fucking kill you. I swear to God.
Well, the new nature of the internet is you're guaranteeing it to happen. But yeah, with this crowd of people, it's going to be so awkward, you'll actually hang up before they get it done. I just was wondering. I just was. Didn't you hang up on them?
Damn it, I didn't get to the flush. Nice. I'll be ready for it. I'll be ready for it. There we go. All right. Goatless says he's from Brisbane. Third generation Aussie. His accent is real.
Yeah. So absolutely.
There
was no question there, was there?
That's why we were late today. That's why we were late, because we were talking about whether or not it was real or not. Jeff had brought this. He went to like some family tree website. He put in a Skype username. We got a bunch of information. He got faxed to us. It's pretty amazing. All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us. We do have the Evil Geniuses Masters Cup coming up next. I'm going to be casting that with Pain User, because it is going to be EG taking on, remind me who you guys play.
Fnatic.
That should be a good matchup. Looking forward to that one. That'll be coming up here in about 10, 15 minutes. Want to give you guys a final word. Final word, Pain User.
Final word. Word of the day. Poonage. I'm about to go cast like 5 million games.
Awesome. Awesome. In Control, final word.
Come say hi to me at Columbus, MLG. I look forward to meeting everyone, and hopefully some of you guys who watch this show will be there.
Will you also be taking like hangout sessions?
Oh yeah, man. I'm not as famous as Idra, but I will I'll let you get close to Idra.
One thing most pro gamers aren't opposed to, like, hanging out with people at all. Like, it's awesome to interact with fans and stuff. Just don't, like, follow them around all the time.
Don't be too rambunctious.
All of MLG. Like, he's going to be looking over his shoulder, and I'm going to be there.
Shit, I'd follow Idra, too.
No, I'm saying you. Pain User.
But like a little train going, you'll follow me and we'll follow you.
Oh, all right, Idra, final word.
Thanks to all my fans and EG and whatnot and all our sponsors.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks to our sponsors here at Inside the Game, Steel Series and Six Pool Gaming. And seriously, guys, all you have to do is, I can't answer everyone's call, obviously, but you can send us email, itg@onemoregame.tv. And, I think at the end of the day, I'm going to give these guys access to that, too. So if they want to pull any questions from there, they can. But you can send anything in. You don't want to hear any more silver questions. Well, I expect then you gold guys to call in and or to write in and to give us those questions. So I want to thank our guests once again, Terran Rep Pain User, Zerg Rep Idra, and Protoss Rep In Control. We got the Evil Geniuses Masters Cup coming up here next, and I'll be casting with Pain User tonight with Idra tomorrow. So make sure you join us. We also have Live on 3. Guys, it's been a blast. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in, guys.
We'll see you next week. Peace.